rules hearing today, and I thank everybody for being here. We're going to start out with House Bill 3477 with a public hearing, because Representative is here. So we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3477. And we'll have a short explanation by our administrator.
Thank you, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. House Bill 3477 prohibits persons from distributing hard copies of telephone directories to residences unless specifically requested in writing or by the Internet. Makes violation an unlawful trade practice. Background information, telephone or phone book paper is 100% recyclable and is used primarily to make new phone books. Old phone books are also recycled into building materials and products used in homes. However, many recyclers will not accept telephone books because the fibers used to produce the book's pages are too short to be used to make new paper. There are now internet sites that allow individuals to have their homes and offices removed from telephone book distribution lists. Companies producing telephone books rely on large distribution numbers to sell the advertising and make redistribution to homes and offices viable.
And with that, Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Jules Copel Bailey, representing House District 42, Inner East Side, Portland. It's a pleasure to be back in front of the Rules Committee again. And I want to start by expressing my sincere thanks to the Chair for his willingness to hear this bill today. House Bill 3477 is a fairly simple bill. It essentially creates, as you just heard, an opt-in system for phone books. Telephone books are a handy resource for residents needing the phone number of a neighbor or to find a local business. It's a great advertising venue for businesses. However, telephone books represent a significant tonnage in the waste stream, approximately 660,000 tons per year. In recent years, the number of phone books delivered to households and businesses has increased, with two or more competing companies now publishing and distributing books in similar overlapping geographic areas. Now, the companies that produce these telephone books have already begun taking some steps to create web-based opt-out system. I applaud their efforts and think that in the future this could potentially be a way of looking at dealing with this issue. However, the usage rate on these opt-out mechanisms is low, and the way that they are set up makes them somewhat difficult to use. And as a result, most residents and businesses lack a way to essentially opt out of receiving those that they don't want. In addition, phone book recycling represents a number of challenges. Phone books are made of low-grade paper and are sometimes distributed with materials that become contaminants in the recycling process, which represents a problem for certain end-use applications. So I want to emphasize that the point of this bill is to reduce waste and to ensure that people who don't want to receive telephone books are not receiving them, that you don't have the books piling up on the doorstep, using them as your doorstop for weeks on end. I do understand that there are still people in our community who see telephone books as a valuable resource, especially in some rural communities, and who for folks that have not yet made the transition to the Internet. We want to acknowledge that that's a valuable use of those of phone books and created a system where they could be dropped off at local post offices, dropped off at local businesses to be picked up and taken home. That said, I also want to express that I am very much open to working with the industry on this bill and to looking at systems that might be variations on opt-out systems versus opt-in systems and to finding a solution that works for small businesses, works for people in urban areas and rural areas, that works for people who are on the Internet and not on the Internet, and that we can find a consensus solution with this bill. But I think it is an important conversation for us to have, because it is a significant source of waste. You'll see letters in front of you from a number of different people that have written in to express their support for this bill. This bill was conceived of by a constituent of mine who unfortunately could not be here today. But there are many people who support the concept, and I hope that we can come to a solution that works for everyone.
Thank you very much. Any questions for this witness? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And we will invite the next as a panel, Brent Wolf, Maggie Stonecipher, Jenny Lang, and Jim Green. and any order you want to go.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Thank you for hearing House Bill 3477. For the record, my name is Jenny Lang. I represent Quest Communications, and with me today is Maggie Stonecipher, Assistant Vice President for Print and Delivery Services from R.H. Donnelly, sort of our expert on the ground on this issue, as well as Jim Green from Verizon and Brant Wolf from the Oregon Telecommunications Association. We're playing back up here today and would be happy to answer questions after Maggie makes a few remarks about this bill. Thank you.
Chairman, members of the committee, thank you very much for your time. And I have prepared written testimony, but I will keep this brief for the sake of time because I know you have much on the agenda. I represent R.H. Donnelly, and we are the largest publisher of telephone directories in the state of Oregon, representing DEX-branded directories for Quest and Embark telephone companies. I'm here in opposition of House Bill 3477, largely because it is unnecessary because of the steps the industry has taken in self-regulation and providing consumers choice. As an industry, and RHD in particular, we have been working on this issue since 2007, and in May 2008, R.H. Donnelly introduced a program called Select Your DEX. And Select Your DEX is a web-based, easy-to-use system. It takes less than 2.5 minutes in which consumers in any of our 28 states may go in and enter their zip code, and they will get a listing of all the directories they receive from us. And they can put in 0 to 3 directories of any or all of those that they choose to receive, and then we will honor that request in our deliveries. Within the industry has also created a website, yellowpagesoptout.com, that consumers can go to, again, put in their zip code, and it will give them a listing of all telephone directories they receive in their zip code so that they have an easy reference tool for information to then call those publishers and request not to receive telephone directories. I wholeheartedly agree with the issue of consumers feeling like they're receiving too many directories from too many different publishers too many times a year. And as an industry, and RHD in particular, we have moved to address that by giving them that choice. We still find that the vast majority of consumers tell us that they do want a telephone directory in their house. They just don't want so many. And as an industry, we have recognized that, and we will continue to recognize that. I do also want to emphasize not only is Select Your DEX a source reduction initiative, but also our efforts on the back end to recycle. In the state of Oregon, over 10,000 tons of telephone directories a year are purchased by one of our paper suppliers, Nippon, which is based in Northwest Washington, and they go into Oregon and Washington and purchase as many telephone directories as they can from recyclers in order to then use those telephone directories to make more directory stock paper. I also want to emphasize that in the manufacturing of our directory stock papers, not a single tree is cut down. We use pre- and post-consumer waste. As Representative Bailey noticed, this is a low-grade paper. It doesn't require virgin paper fibers. In addition, we work with other suppliers, such as Green Fiber, which purchases as many telephone directories as we can get to them to manufacture insulation for homes. And they are one of the leading providers in the country of recyclable home insulation. Again, I've prepared more detailed written testimony, but for the sake of time, I want to keep this short. I also want to add that this industry directly employs over 500 Oregon residents in the sales, manufacturing, and distribution of telephone directories. So House Bill 3477 not only would impact consumers in not having what they consider this ready source of information that they have been entitled to for years and are used to getting, but it also impacts the livelihood of many residents in the state. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for this panel? I guess my only question is, it appears you're already developing your own opt-out system for people. Would having a bill for an opt-out system be something that would be positive in helping highlight the fact that it's already there? I mean, sometimes getting the message out is the biggest problem. And it may not be this time, but down the road, would you guys be interested in some kind of legislation that really promotes the idea of opting out and then addressing the idea that there are ways in which you could get that to happen?
From an industry perspective, my company, R.H. Donnelley, was able to move so quickly because we had an extensive database of all consumers already for delivery purposes. An opt-out bill or opt-out legislation requiring it needs to recognize that this will take some time, particularly for smaller publishers, to develop the systems to be able to handle this. Then the execution on the street is really the challenge. And that's where I've gone in and worked with other publishers and am available to any publishers to help them with that execution on the street because we've been able to solve many of those problems. Opt-out legislation, my concern would be what would be the restrictions, the penalties, those things that we can certainly dialogue about. But R.H. Donnelley does believe in consumer choice and providing that in whatever method we can.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jim Green with Verizon. As to that point, I guess one of the concerns that Maggie brought up that I would echo as well is the penalties, because this bill has it as an unfair trade practices act, and I don't believe it rises to that level. When we met with Representative Bailey, he indicated that legislative council put that in as the penalty. I guess that would want, if you were going to go that route at some future legislative session, we'd want to have a discussion along those lines, because having someone who delivers the book to somebody's doorstep get an unfair trade practices violation against them and have the AG potentially bring action or civil action, that seems a bit harsh.
Thank you. Representative Berger.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Stonecipher. One of the nice things about our new technology is that you can verify things pretty fast, and I am on Select My Dex, and I am in the process of selecting my Dex, and one of the questions that I have about these kinds of websites is they ask for my email, and I don't just give my email to anybody, so it's the kind of site where I go, okay, who's going to get all that information? So you're right there. Why don't, before I hit submit, tell me who you share that with, because that's a concern on these kinds of sites.
And I completely understand that. That's a question I've been asked many times. The reason why we ask for an email address and a phone number is we send out a confirmation back. We do have several social activist sites that claim that they take information, and unfortunately when this started we were receiving a lot of bogus information. So it's a way of sending an email confirmation back to you confirming your choice. No one sees that literally other than my team. I'm responsible for the distribution of these directories. It's not seen by any other group. It's not used for any purposes. We address this in our privacy notice on our website. It is not sold. It is not used for any other communication purposes. And it's a way to confirm back to you your choice. Our delivery database system is set up based upon phone number. Because it was originally set up because we received new connects from Quest and Embark, largely based upon phone number. And so that's how we confirm that we've got the right record by matching name, address, and phone number. So that's why we asked for those two pieces.
With that answer, Mr. Chair, I have selected and submitted, and this is a very good system. Thank you.
It's been my baby for 2 years, and I'm proud to say I've been associated with it.
Thank you very much. Any other questions? I see none. Thank you. There was no one else signed up to speak on this bill, so we are going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3477. And thank you all for being here. We're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2003. And we'll have a short explanation by our administrator, and our representative, Stiegler, can take her place.
Thank you, Chair Roblin. Members of the committee, House Bill 2003 extends immunity from suit to landowners who permit the public to use their property for gardening for a fee of no more than $25 per year. It extends immunity from suit to landowners who allow the public to travel across their property to access adjacent areas for the purpose of recreation, gardening, woodcutting, or the harvest of special forest products. State law already provides immunity from suit for personal injury, death, or property damage as against both private and public landowners who allow others to use their property for recreational purposes, woodcutting, and the harvest of special forest products. That is ORS 105.682. House Bill 2003 adds gardening to that list and extends the same immunity to adjacent landowners who allow the public to travel across their property in order to access those areas for those purposes.
Representative Stiegler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. Yeah, the community as well.
Good afternoon.
For record, I'm Judy Stigler, representative House District 54, City of Bend and environs around there. I come to you today as the chief sponsor of House Bill 2003, which is, as the committee administrator indicated, is a bill to essentially respond to a Supreme Court ruling that came down in this state in late 2006. For some 40 years, this state has had a policy, both in statute and in practice, of encouraging landowners to open their properties for certain purposes like recreation, hunting, wood cutting, etc. And it had long been thought that those who allowed people to cross their property to get to those sites were protected by the same statutes that gave immunity to the landowner opening up their property for those purposes. What happened in late 2006 was the case of Liberty versus State of Oregon, which made it very clear that the statutory immunity that related to the actual property where the person was recreating, hunting, fishing, wood cutting, etc., that same immunity did not extend to the property over which persons travel to reach that property. So as an example, if you're traveling to or from the beach or, say, a lake, and you cross either private or public property to get there, the property that you cross to get to that place of recreation or et cetera, that landowner would not be protected. So what this bill is intended to do is to extend that immunity to the landholders of that property. And I want to point out a couple of things here. Owner the definition of owner is clarified so that it's not just the possessor of the interest in the land, but also the holder of fee title, a tenant, a lessee, occupant, the holder of an easement, the holder of a right-of-way, or a person in possession of the land. So it clarifies exactly what's intended by owner, which I believe, in looking at the history, that is consistent with the legislative intent that of many years, of some 40 years ago, where the statutory immunity originally arose. This came to me as a concern of various constituents in my area, an irrigation district, Parks and Recreation District, the City of Bend, the City of Redmond, all of whom, as public property owners, are impacted by these things, where they have maybe bike trails or there's a park that they have and people have to cross. So it's of keen interest to a large group of people. And again, I want to emphasize, it's not just public landholders, it's private landholders as well. And what we did was work very hard. Just backing up, you should have letters in front of you from the City of Bend, the City of Redmond, and the Bend Park and Recreation District, which support this measure. This has been carefully crafted to minimize any fiscal impact, and I think my understanding is you do have a fiscal indication that there's just a minimal fiscal impact on this as a result of this. Additionally, we worked very hard to make sure that there were no provisions in this that would be objectionable to various parties, and essentially I think that people on all sides of this issue are on at least neutral on the bill if they're not actively supporting it. So I'd be happy to get into specifics. I would add, you'll note here that there's gardening. Mr. Watson mentioned the addition of gardening, and that was done at the behest, I think, of Senator Starr, and there's a limitation. These are to cover those community garden kinds of situations which are sprouting up, no pun intended, all across the state. Really, there was.
It's Friday afternoon.
I know, it's Friday afternoon. And, you know, it's intended to be able to cover those kinds of situations. And the idea is that these should be truly community gardens with only a minimal, i.e. a $25 fee. And if it goes beyond that, then we're outside the realm of the community garden concept, and those wouldn't be covered. So gardening was added in to both the type of property, such as recreation, hunting, wood cutting, et cetera, as well as the property to get to and from. So And again, I would be happy to answer any questions.
Are there any questions for this witness?
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
It's Friday afternoon.
That's true.
Maybe that's a good thing. No.
Mark Landauer, Steve Johnson, and Marianne Fitzgerald.
Good afternoon, Chair Roblin, members of the committee, Mark Landauer with the Special Districts Association of Oregon. Thank you, Chair Roblin, for hearing this bill today. Representative Stiegler has done a magnificent job describing the bill. Frankly, I don't have much more to add. You have my written testimony before you. Much of that was covered by Representative Stiegler. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have. I will also note that Mr. Johnson, to my right here, is the director of the Central Oregon Irrigation District and explain to you, is here to explain to you the importance of this bill, particularly to his folks in the Central Oregon area.
Thank you. Yes. Steve Johnson, manager of Central Oregon Irrigation District, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'll keep it brief. The impact, if this immunity is not clarified to the irrigation district that I represent, is we have miles of canals that run through Central Oregon that are currently being utilized as trails through the Redmond Park District, City of Redmond, City of Bend, and the Bend Metro Park and Recreation District. And frankly, if there's going to be liability exposure, then we won't be able to continue to allow the ditch roads that go along our canals to be used as trails. If this bill does pass, then there won't be the problem, and the irrigation district will be able to continue the good relationships that we've had for recreation in our area.
Thank you very much. And we'll have our third person. And
My name is Marianne Fitzgerald. I live in Southwest Portland, and I'm representing the Southwest Neighborhoods, Inc., part of Representative Nolan's district. We are a nonprofit in Southwest Portland in an area that has few sidewalks and bike paths. And over the last 10 years, we've developed an extensive network of trails as a way to help our people walk safely. We want to make it safer through this bill, and we were supporting the City of Portland's efforts, working very closely with the City of Portland to try to broaden the definition of trails, broaden the definition of recreational uses. So if somebody is walking to a bus stop, is that a recreational use? We want to try to protect people for various uses of trails. I realize the long agenda that you have today, so I'll rely on my written testimony. But I just want to say that because of liability issues, that some of the neighbors in Southwest Portland are nervous about allowing the trails to be constructed. They've actually ripped out stairs in the public right-of-way because they're afraid of liability issues and really hampered our ability to get around. So we want to clarify the legal response or the legal language to try to extend the immunity to the property owners and the public right-of-way and those adjacent to the property owners. I've submitted with you the City of Portland language that has been working, the city's been working on. I understand that there are some issues about it possibly being too broad, and if that's the case, we would like to work with you to make it more amenable so that we could cover the urban trails as well as the rural trails.
Questions for this group? I really appreciate what Portland is trying to do here. We found out that I had a very large high school, and it had lots of new construction, which left these places, stairways and all sorts of stuff outside, and kids were skateboarding all the time, which was a difficult deal to deal with. And finally, when they were looking at statutes, the lawyer said, for the school district, to make it a skate park and you're done. It's safe. There's no liability issue. You know, as long as it's a school, it's a problem. But if it's a skate park and you identify it, we didn't go that way. We tended to try to keep control. But you do have to identify, I mean, that recreational issue, the discussion is an important one. I'm not sure these amendments are quite right yet, and I'm personally feeling that it's getting late. We need to move the bill. And I would work with you or whoever, as we get it to the Senate, to see if we can get something like that, because that makes some sense. Representative Nolan.
Just a quick comment, Mr. Chair. Certainly, the City of Portland deserves credit for what they're doing for these kinds of things, but I'd really like to put on the record that it is the volunteer neighborhood associations that are really leading the effort and providing a good bit of the vision for it, and thank you.
But this liability issue is a big issue, and I understand that, and I think we can get to some definitions, but let's work on that one, and I don't want to mess it up in the middle as well. So I appreciate your testimony. Any other questions? And I truly appreciate what you're doing, because I think trails and outside activity for everybody is a really good thing. So
yes,
thank you.
Safe.
Thank you. With that, I have no one else on my list, so we will close our public hearing on House Bill 2003, and I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2003, and I would take a motion. Would you like to make a motion?
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 2003 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Gelser moves House Bill 2003 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. There's enough of this.
All right.
Is there any discussion?
Notice the nonpartisan vote that's about to happen.
Yeah, always. It's very nice. We'll take a roll
we're
call.
Just we were
vote.
Just commenting
yes,
on how both our districts have streets with no sidewalks in them.
We'll take a roll call vote.
Representative
Gelser?
Aye.
Representative
Nolan?
Yes.
Representative Reed?
Aye.
Vice Chair Berger?
Excused. That's good.
Vice Chair Edwards?
He's excused as well.
Chair
Wilson. Aye. Motion passes, and we will send this on the floor. Representative Steger, would you wish to carry?
Absolutely.
Okay, we'll have you do that. Thank you very much. So we'll close our work session on House Bill 2003, and I'm trying to figure out who has been coming back the most. We have long agendas, and I want to tell people we don't always get through everything. So we go out a little bit of order. Some of these people have been waiting a lot longer than others. So I'm thinking that House Bill 3232A has, I've been seeing the same faces for a long time. So we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3232A. We'll have a short explanation by our administrator.
Thank you, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. House Bill 3232A modifies provisions relating to the administration and regulation of boards, councils, and programs for which the Oregon Health Licensing Agency is responsible, increases the term of office of certain board and council members from 3 to 4 years, eliminates the need for audiologists to hold separate license to dispense hearing aids, increases the number of members of the State Board of Direct Entry Midwifery from 7 to 8, by adding a public member, creates crime of tattooing persons under 18 years of age, creates a crime of genital or nipple piercing of persons under 18 years of age, specifies that both crimes carry penalties, punishment of maximum 1 year imprisonment, $6,250 fine, or both. There are two amendments before you. The -7 amendment deletes the provisions prohibiting tattooing or providing genital or nipple piercing to persons under 18 years of age. The -8 amendment deletes language providing that the governor may remove members of various boards for neglect of duty, incompetence, or unethical conduct, and it modifies provisions relating to licensing and dispensing hearing aids. Oregon administrative rules currently prohibit tattooing minors. House Bill 3232A adds enforcement provisions. In Oregon, audiologists must be licensed by the Oregon Board of Examiners for speech pathology, and audiology must also have a separate license to dispense hearing aids. Under House Bill 3232A, dispensing hearing aids would fall under the authority of the BSPA. The current 7-member board, 4 members must be licensed direct entry midwives. The board currently has no public member. The bill adds a public member with an 8-member board, direct entry midwives would no longer constitute an outright majority.
Thank you very much. And with that, do we have a list of all the people?
No.
Speaking. Okay, and this must be Brian DeForest.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. For the record, Brian DeForest, the acting director for the Oregon Health Licensing Agency. We thank the chair and the committee for hearing 3232A and also for entertaining the Dash 8 amendments. As we worked with our stakeholder groups on the original language of 3232, we realized that there were a couple of problems. We've reached out to the Oregon Hearing Society to postpone establishment of a two-year program for the hearing aid specialists. During the interim, we're going to work more closely with that society and come up with language that we can both agree on. We thought we had agreement, and when I came on board with the agency, I realized that we did not have that agreement. So we want to take time to work with them and get it right before coming forward with new proposed language. The same thing would be true with our partnership with the Oregon Department of Education. This relates to cosmetology schools in the state of Oregon. The agency had proposed language, not realizing that the Department of Education may have some issues with that. We met with Department of Education and bring forward language in the amendment to delete proposed language in 3232A. During the interim, we're actually going to work with Department of Education to work on a transition plan for curricula that currently resides under the authority of education with the potential of bringing under health licensing agency, which would be in line with what other states already do. And then finally, the language change with the governor's appointment so that board and council members serve at the pleasure of the governor. This is in line with other legislation that's already moved to the Senate side and just brings us consistent with what they have as well. And with regards to the Dash 7 amendments, while we're not proposing it, we certainly do not object to them.
Okay. Any questions? Representative Girard.
Yes, sir. Are you duplicating the responsibilities of any other state agencies or boards?
Mr. Chair, Representative Girard, I'm not aware of any other duplications that we perform. We do end up with a lot of discussion on scope of practice and end up with issues such as how closely are we compared to massage technicians, how close are the are the respiratory therapists into other disciplines of health-related disciplines, that is. But we try to maintain very fine lines so that there is no duplication.
Okay. Thank you.
What are we doing?
Any other questions? This bill came to us from the floor, actually, and we felt we needed a couple changes to make. I appreciate you coming. The two amendments are the amendments that we felt needed changed.
Which ones? You want me to do this? Yeah, because I missed the whole show.
Okay. All right. So the sevens and eights, I would entertain. Oh, wait, we're not there yet because I got to close
the
public
hearing.
You got
to open a work session.
Yep. So anybody else that came here specifically to talk about this one? Seeing no one, we're going to close the public hearing. We're going to open a work session on House Bill 3232A. Representative Nolan.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move that the committee adopt the Dash A7 amendment to House Bill 3232.
Representative Nolan moves that we adopt the Dash 7 A7 amendments to House Bill 3232. Any discussion? Seeing none, any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. Representative Nolan.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I also move that we adopt the Dash A8 amendment to House Bill 3232.
Representative Nolan moves that we adopt the Dash A8 amendments to House Bill 3232. Is there any discussion on the Dash A's? No, we've already passed that. Seeing any objection, none. Well, so ordered. Representative Nolan.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3232A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Nolan moves the House Bill 3232A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Yes. Comment
just,
here.
Just for the record, we do have fiscal and revenue on both of these. They are minimal fiscals and zero revenues on both.
Okay. So without any discussion on the bill, seeing them, we'll take a roll call vote.
Representative Gerard?
Aye.
Representative Gelser?
Aye.
Representative Nolan?
Yes.
Representative Reed?
Aye.
Vice Chair Berger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Edwards?
Aye.
Aye. Motion passes, and I'm trying to remember who carried this on the floor the first time. I will assign myself unless I find someone else to this bill. So with that, we'll close our work session on 3232A. And we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3237. And we'll have a short explanation.
Thank you, Chair Roblin. Members of the committee, House Bill 3237 provides the, in the original version, provides the election ballots list the names of all political parties that have nominated candidates for election and requires the Secretary of State to include statements in the voter's pamphlet regarding the nominating process. There are several amendments that you, I believe, have in your packet. There is a dash 3 amendment that replaces the bill in several sections of the statutes regarding elections. Sections 1 to 3 of the amendment changes language in ballot titles imprinted on ballot envelopes for measures authorizing the renewal of certain local option taxes to state the measure renews current local option taxes, and this statement cannot be considered for purpose of the word count limitations. Adds additional options for ballot title question language and applies to measures submitted to people at an election held after the effective date. This amendment really addresses two areas, some of the concerns that were in the original measure plus the issue of how you describe ballot titles when you're having a renewal election. And the dash 4, I believe we'll have to get someone to explain. There may be an issue with it.
Okay. So with that, I need the list. We'll get our list of people who are ready to testify. So with that, we're going to invite Justin Black and Dana Trahune. And yeah, we'll start with that group.
3237. Chair Roblin, members of the committee, Justin Black from the Oregon Education Association. The Oregon Education Association represents about 48,000 workers in the education community, all the way from pre-K to community college and all over the place. I come today to talk about the Dash 3 amendments. There's some, I think, some distinct portions of the bill. The first one in Section 1 is some language that we actually, Dana Trahune, who's next to me, came up with. We were looking at the outside of envelopes when you pass a local bond option
just
in a school
district. Make sure you identify yourself.
Oh, sorry. Justin Black from the Oregon Education Association.
Thank you.
Sorry. There's some clarifying language around when a school district or any other local district goes out to renew a bond. Currently on the outside of the ballot, it says contains vote on proposed tax increase. We'd like to change that so it just says contains vote on renewal of current local option taxes, so that if a school district or other local government is just renewing their bond option, that is conveyed to the voters of they're not actually voting to raise their taxes above what they are now. They're just voting to continue the level of support that they're already giving. Then it goes into Section 3. There's a couple changes in precinct, the way precincts are drawn, and we've run into this as we try to canvass for local bond options and other school-related things. The first one is that precincts be contained in legislative districts, congressional and state leg and state senate districts, and we've actually got in the handout that you have
some examples of where we've run into precincts that are actually split among legislative districts. I think Representative Gelser actually has a precinct in her district that she shares with another representative, and it creates a little confusion, I know, with our members of which district they actually live in when we tell them which precincts they live in, and so we're hoping to just straighten that out. The effective date on that is not until after redistricting, so that when you guys go through your hubbub in a couple of years of redrawing all the lines, that these rules would just apply from there forward, so that the county clerks don't have to make changes right now. The other one is island districts. We've run into some precincts that are very large and then have a little island outside of them. There's actually a map of that on page 2 of a district in Washington County, where you'll see at the bottom precinct 354, and then there's,
if you look directly above it, it's a little island of itself.
So this would just require that those be two separate precincts to cut down on confusion. And then the third point I have is to just bring down the number of electors that are in a precinct. When the move to vote by mail happened, precincts went from a relatively reasonable number to 5,000, which is a rather large precinct to deal with. We just kind of threw a number out there of 1,000 so that they're more manageable to deal with. Then Section 4, as we looked at election results from the 2006 election and 2008 election, we noticed that the Secretary of State didn't always report the same results that the county reported and how many ballots were cast and the results. So we just look forward to a standardized way of there being electronic results going from the county level to the Secretary of State level when they do the official result at the end of an election. And then finally, Section 5, as you know, the Oregon Education Association is often involved in ballot measures and the signature verification process. We've run into issues where there are many counties that let us witness the verification process, similar as you would watch a vote recount. There are a couple counties that don't allow us. We've also had issues with the Secretary of State, sometimes allowing, sometimes not allowing. This would just be so there would be a standardized level of giving access to the verification process. But we also did put some language in there so that we couldn't overwhelm a county clerk, so that they could just allow as much as does not interfere with their workload. And with that, I will close.
Thank you, Justin.
Thank you, Chair Roblin and members of the committee. My name is Dana Trehune, and I live in Tualatin. I'm here today regarding some proposed wording changes on the right now. I'll just give you a little history. In 2000, our local school district, the voters approved a local option levy for our school district. And at that time, it was very clear it was a tax increase. I mean, that if approved, property taxes could go up by over 3%, even though they were they would go up. Then again, the voters approved in 2004 and 2008 approved the renewal of the local option levy. However, this time the ballot measure wording still said it may increase property taxes by more than 3%. When I worked on these measures in 2004 and 2008, voters would say to me, but it says right here in the voter's pamphlet, property taxes may go up. And I had to explain time and time again that it wasn't possible for the tax rate to be more than, that the tax rate was going to stay constant if this was renewed. It would, so therefore, taxes could not go up more than 3% because the assessed value could not go up more than 3%. It's a very confusing issue to voters. And along with that, on the envelope, as Justin pointed out, it says currently contains a vote on a proposed tax increase. Again, if it's a renewal, it is renewing a tax that is on the books, so there is no way that the taxes can go up.
So questions, sir? Representative Girard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If it said in the pamphlet, the voter's pamphlet, may increase taxes, how would you rephrase that? I mean, what's your heart's desire to substitute for that? Because you're saying may raise taxes is not an accurate reflection of the situation. So how would you reword that?
The proposed wording would say this measure renews the current local option taxes.
Thank you.
And then as well on the ballot, on the outside of the ballot, the envelope, it would say it contains, excuse me, let me make sure I get this correct, contains vote on renewal of current local option taxes.
Okay. Representative Berger.
If the voters defeat the measure, do their taxes go down?
Yes.
So, isn't it technically true that it is a vote on a tax increase?
No. You have your tax rate, and the first time you vote for it, I will, yes. And you do get that additional tax increase on that. At that point, though, if you renew it, your tax rate will not go up. It's going to continue that same tax rate.
But without the vote, they would drop.
Sure.
You have to have the vote, or they would, without renewal, they would drop.
Sure. And can I jump in, Chair Roblin, Vice Chair Berger? You know, and I think we could add some, you know, contains vote on renewal of current local option of taxes and may decrease your taxes in there. Because if they do vote, I mean, that's the way it's either going to stay current or go down.
Right.
Many voters out there are very confused with the current wording because it is very, it's gray. So we were just trying to,
I'm not sure that they're as confused as you think. They know that a yes vote will hit their pocketbook in a different way than a no vote. And a no vote will leave more money in their pockets than a yes vote.
I respectfully actually disagree with that. Because voters say that this will increase my taxes. Their tax rate is staying the same if this is renewed.
But if it isn't renewed,
then their tax rate will go down. But that is the point. And every time when I explain this to them, they said, well, but this isn't what it says. It says my taxes are going to be increased. My tax rate is going to go up. And your tax rate will not go up.
Your rate may not, but your taxes will go down if it's defeated.
Yes, and I think with the wording, if you say that it contains a vote on a renewal, this measure renews current local option taxes, more voters understand that if I vote yes, it's going to continue, and if I vote no, it will go down.
I
think that's more reflective of the true.
Mr. Chair,
yep.
I have never been approved, very approving of any of this language on a ballot, period, at all. And I think that our discussion reflects why. No matter what you put on that ballot, it's confusing. Thank you.
I agree.
Thank you. Representative Girard.
Mr. Chair, I would ask to be excused and that I have a Ways and Means meeting also at this time. So
yeah, we still have our quorum.
You need me, call me, you have my number.
Yeah, we know. Thank you. Further questions for this panel?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Gelser.
I just wanted to indicate how important I think that precinct part is. It's very confusing. Not only do we have split legislative district precincts in my district, we have split congressional district precincts in my district. I can go walking in my district and one side of the street is the 5th Congressional District and the other side of the street is the 4th Congressional District. There is no good guess about why and how we're all districted to where we are within the city of Corvallis, but it would be wonderful to know that you lived in the same precinct as your next-door neighbor.
Thank you.
And the same legislative district.
And I think you mentioned it, but I actually believe that there are some that get cut in such ways that you could actually identify an individual person's vote.
Yeah, Chair Robin, and in fact, there's an example of one of those in Marion County that's in this packet. We didn't name the person.
Yes.
Also in my district, I have two voters in one precinct of Lane County. That pretty much, so there are only two voters in that county. So in
so
that return,
pretty much
it's pretty clear because they always vote the same way.
Okay, so you have that same. Okay. Seems like you have all of these issues.
Mr. Chair, it's all about Corvallis and Chiquita the Chihuahua from Philomath.
There we go. Okay. Thank you both. Next, we have Jan Coleman and David Williams and Ross Day. Might as well get all of you up here. So, Jan, go first if you'd like.
Thank you, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. I'm Jan Coleman. I'm with the Oregon Association of County Clerks. And as you guys know, I'm the retired Yamhill County Clerk. House Bill 3237 appears to me like it's getting gotten stuffed. So I'm here to reference the original bill, which looks like it reflects a lot of what we've already discussed on House Bill 2414.
Right.
So you've heard all that already. Okay. Progressing on to the Dash 3 amendments, which are basically what clerks would be concerned about.
The initial part in Section 1 references new language in the ballot title. We really don't have any problem with what they're recommending there. It does take up more space on the ballot, but not significantly. As far as the language on the outside of the envelope is concerned, we have several concerns with that. Basically, it's really not changing the message. It's, again, you're voting on a tax. One thing that we want to know is how would we address this if we had two measures on the same ballot, one that's a renewal and one that isn't? What do we put on the envelope? And frankly, if you get too much on the envelope, it looks like bulk mail. We worry about that. So anyway, the other thing is definitely clerks order envelopes in bulk orders. So this would break down to three different orders, which, needless to say, costs us more money. So that's a concern for us, plus storage of three different types of outside envelopes. And let's see, progressing on to Section 3, the precincts. Actually, I worked in elections for 26 years. We have been making the precincts larger during that time. Now they can be 5,000. The reason we did in 1999, it went up to that, and it was because vote by mail makes it much easier for us to handle the larger precincts. And frankly, the larger precincts are much easier for us to handle. Lots less data entry when you're setting up elections and so forth. Most of us print ballots by precinct. So, therefore, less changes with the printer for different precincts, it's cheaper. And actually, with the inserters at the insertion place, again, less changes with all the different inserting, so it's cheaper. islands, you are probably never going to get away from islands. And that is because we work with cities who do annexations. I had the same situation. And you have land inside the city that basically is surrounded by things that have been annexed, but this piece hasn't. So therefore, this has to be in the precinct that's outside the city. It cannot be contiguous. So, you know, and if you had that one as a separate precinct, you're definitely going to know how those people voted. So those are the problems. The other thing, a lot of this does arise in some of those counties maybe that aren't separating the legislative and the congressional could do that. Most of us try to do that, frankly. It makes life simpler for us do that. However, when we redistrict because of the census, And I will tell you that that has not been a fun thing for us in many times. The census is done. They draw legislative lines, and sometimes they mess it up. We had for 10 years two people that were in a city that the line got drawn incorrectly, and they then, therefore, these two people were in their own precinct because they really should have been in this one, but now they were in this one, and we had to carry them separately. They ended up in a whole different representative district, et cetera, incorrectly. But that was that way for 10 years. So some of this is because what we have to deal with when the census comes and we do the redistricting, and it's done by legislature. Section 4 deals with electronic reporting to precincts. Actually, we do a lot of that right now, and it's in an in-progress situation. Within our centralized voter registration system, they have developed a election reporting system. And right now we're doing input, but the ultimate goal is that it will transfer results from your ballot tally system right into that, which then connects with the Secretary of State site. So that is in progress as we speak. And as far as Section 5 goes, observers, we have a vote by mail manual, which is adopted by administrative rule that says we have to have observers or signature verification, et cetera. So I'm not sure what counties are not permitting that. I do know that some counties are very limited for space and therefore have to limit sometimes to only one person at a time.
Okay.
Yep. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, David Williams with the Oregon School Boards Association, testifying here on House Bill 3237 and the Dash 3 amendments, and specifically Sections 1 and 2 in support of my colleagues. And I will briefly applaud Mr. Kuhn, who did not also identify herself as one of Oregon's newest public servants, a school board member-elect for the Tigard-Walden School Board as well. I want to testify in support of these as really a truth in advertising for elections and ballots. I think that there is, in all honesty, there is some confusion when the language is presented. I would really second Representative Berger's comments, and the difficulty in containing rather nuanced issues within six words or, as is being proposed here, nine words. But really trying to more accurately reflect what is contained within that ballot that the voter is going to vote on, and would urge an aye vote on those sections 1 and 2 of the bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Day.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For your record, Ross Day, Executive Director of Common Sense for Oregon. I'm here to testify in support of the Dash 4 amendment to House Bill 3237. But first, I want to let the committee know, just for your edification, the Oregon State Beavers won today 9-8.
Appreciate that. Thank you.
Not that I was paying attention to that more than I was what was going on in the hearing, but
just want to point out it's Corvallis again.
Thank you. But Representative Clem asked me to keep him up to date, so okay. I was just doing what he asked me to. The Dash 4 amendments make a change to House Bill 2005A, which this committee considered before. The Dash 3 amendments to that bill, which the chair introduced for me, basically allowed us, when a chief petitioner, when we hire somebody to circulate an initiative petition, we have to certify that they're okay to sign to circulate it. Well, you have under the current law, you have to have the chief petitioner have to sign each one of those. You could have 50 people. The point was they could designate somebody to sign on their behalf, which is just going to speed up the process. Well, in drafting that language, the last sentence basically would allow us to create a shield from liability for chief petitioners from any violation of the law, which was certainly not what we were asking for. So this was a good catch by Ms. Wilson in the Secretary of State's office, and we fully support the amendment. So happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for anyone here? I want to thank you for pointing out the problems. I hadn't thought about islands. They've been a problem in a lot of different ways with respect to how we annex things, and I didn't realize how they played into this. I appreciate that information. So I thank you again for coming, and thank you, Mr. Day, for continuing to reinforce the fact that you are consistent when you come about doing these things, and I appreciate you coming back to testify on this one, because I wasn't quite sure how this was explained to me once. You do a better job sometimes of explaining why this works than I get sometimes. So I appreciate that, and appreciate your forthrightness in recognizing this was the way it should be. So thank you for that, too. So, Representative Berger.
No, Mr. Chair, do we have more testimony on this bill?
I think this is it.
Well, then I just wanted to comment on one other provision in, I think, the dash threes that I forgot to mention when I had my chance, and that is that limit of 1,000 per precinct. I guess I'm not really thinking that that's such a great idea, and I wanted that on the record.
So let's excuse this group, and I think I would invite Justin Black back just to maybe answer a little bit of that question.
Roblin, Vice Chair Berger, I think we would be open to changing that number as well. It just felt like a manageable number.
I guess the question is manageable for whom?
I think it was manageable for us when the way we look at precincts, when we're looking at when we're running our school bond campaigns, and it just seemed like a good manageable number of voters to deal with at one time for us. And I understand the clerk's perspective of it, and that's why I think even moving back up to the 5,000, the way she talked about it made sense.
Thank you.
Thank you. So that would take a little bit of change, but not much. So, yeah. And we don't have the paperwork for these amendments yet with regard to the school and so on. So if we can get that worked out, I think we're pretty much ready. Is there any other issues with respect to these bills? Because I would like to move it, but I think that's a good change. So. Okay. So thank you very much. So we will close our public hearing on House Bill 3237, and we're going to carry over 3237's work session to next week, just so people know. Checking my time, just so people know who are in the audience here, we set up a work session for House Bill 3100, and it's a bill that our committee has not heard before, and so we're going to have about 40 minutes on that bill, and so when we get there, when we're getting close to that period of time, so I think we have time for one more bill before we can actually do that one. And
I think 3240 would be a great bill.
26 would be better.
Or 20, well, we've also got people here for a...
I'll do 3240.
3240 or 3004.
Oh, yeah, we're going to open a work session on 3004. And we'll have a short explanation. We heard this just the other day, and I think we have now the paperwork for that bill. So,
thank you, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. House Bill 3004A provides that foreclosure and sale by the trustee of residential property precludes further action for a deficiency against homeowners on any additional trustee for the property given as security for an obligation without exceptions. Declares emergency. It's effective on passage. We previously discussed the provisions of the measure, the intent of the measure to target unfair practices of some lenders, the idea that it was not applicable to later refinancing by the homeowner, nor applicable to a subsequent lender or creditor that is not affiliated with the original lender or creditor. There are two amendments which you have seen and previously adopted. They are the dash 11 and the dash 12. We received a zero fiscal and revenue on each. And I believe that's
okay.
All
I'll pass that down and see. Okay. Does anyone want to have Representative, I think, Clem help bring this bill to us? And if I'm come in for a second, to give any further understanding of this bill? We don't seem to need it, so I would entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3004A to the floor.
As amended,
to the floor with due pass recommendation.
Representative Edwards moves House Bill 3004A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, we'll take a roll call vote.
Representative Girard?
Aye.
Representative Gelzer?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Excuse?
Representative Nolan?
Yes.
Representative Reed?
Aye.
Vice Chair Berger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Edwards?
Aye.
Chair Roblin?
Aye. Motion passes, and
Clem can carry. I'll speak to it, but
Representative Edwards can carry. And I'm going to do a real quick, because I think we have 5 minutes, and I think I can get it in 5 minutes. We're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2600, and that will take longer. 2600, and I'll turn the gavel over to my esteemed vice chair, so I can talk about this bill.
You opened a hearing on the wrong bill.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, please. Okay. Thank you, Vice Chair Edwards and members of the committee. House Bill 2600 requires that providers of transient lodging ensure the availability of a lift system to allow persons with disabilities to access the bed, toilet, and shower or bathtub. It applies only to newly constructed facilities of 50 or more rooms or facilities remodeled, renovated, or reconstructed after the effective date. There is an amendment, and the amendment replaces the original measure. It narrows the application of the statute, increases to 175 the number of rooms in a facility before installation of a lift system is required, permits lodging providers to choose the type of lift system to be installed, defines the lift system, and limits the liability of owners of lodging place to injury caused by gross negligence or recklessness. According to a report issued in 2000 by the University of California Disabilities Statistics Center, almost 7 million community-based Americans use some form of assistive device. Almost 2 million of those use wheelchairs or scooters, while the balance use canes, walkers, or crutches. Almost one-third of mobility device users need assistance from another person for the daily activities of living. Proponents of this legislation assert that the cost of lift devices range from $600 to $2,000, and that potential liability issues for business owners is minimal compared to the impact the installation of such devices would have on the independence and dignity of Oregon's disabled population. Opponents of the legislation say the bill creates too much liability potential for installation, maintenance, and use of the equipment, and that systems costs are much higher than those estimated by advocates. The amendment is intended to address at least some of those concerns.
Thank you. And Representative Roblin, you want to kick us off? And I believe we have a few other representatives that may be here to speak on this bill.
I don't think they're here for this bill. I think they're here for the next one.
Oh, for the next one? Okay.
Representative Clem may, however, if he wished to. This bill came to us from another committee that Representative Tomei was the chair of. And when I first talked about this bill, people thought that I was talking about Todd, who was a student at my school, and they thought it was Todd who works here. Both have had some impact on this bill for me. We had a young man who actually Representative Clem lived next door to and used to take care of. He had a degenerative disease and eventually passed away, but while he was in high school. He was in a wheelchair for most of his life, and he came to our school and helped us figure out how to make our school a place for handicapped kids to be actively engaged in. And he actually helped our community do the same by getting cutouts and sidewalks and doing other things. And you'd find him everywhere because he was not going to let his disability keep him from being involved in activities. And what what this bill is about is saying that we have this community of people who are in these wheelchairs, and they need the opportunity to be able to go and be part of our recreation community, going to a hotel and going to the beach and doing things. But when they go now, they have to take a caravan of materials. If they are going to get out of their wheelchair, and there's lifts that take them, there's lifts that get them into the restrooms and all of those different issues. We have had people in the past who just tried to get their parent or their spouse to lift them. We've had many, many back injuries caused by those kinds of issues. And today, the advancements in the lift care systems have made it, I think, time is right to start working to get those things available. And I want to really express my gratitude to the hotel people, and we have a person here to speak to that, in coming up with a solution that can move this forward today as opposed to waiting. So with that, I'll turn it over because I think the amendments speak to that. We do have some little amendments that need to be made. I'd like to move this bill. We've all agreed that the Senate could take care of them. It would be easier if we could do that. So with that, I'll turn it over to my guest to the right.
Please. Thank you. Vice Chair Edwards and committee members, Chair Roblin, thanks so much for the opportunity. My name is Jeff Hampton. I'm the president of the Oregon Lodging Association office in Wilsonville, and I just want to, on behalf of our industry members and the association, thank Chair Roblin and others on this committee and in the Human Services Committee that was referenced earlier for work in helping to find a collaborative solution that we think will work for the industry and the small businesses in Oregon. So here to offer my support for the Dash 4 amendments, and there are a few areas that I, as Chair Roblin had mentioned, believe need to be worked out. There's an integrated seat that's called for in that, and we want to make sure that the devices that this law addresses allow the use of a sling or a harness to support the individual, and additionally, that the language around remodeling and renovation is a major remodel that would be one that would otherwise trigger other ADA compliance upgrades. With that, I just thank you for the opportunity and thank Chair Roblin for helping with the collaboration.
Thank you. Members of the committee, any questions? Okay. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Next, we'll call up Bob Esterbrook and Nicole Palmatier Armstrong.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, my name is Nicole Palmatier Armstrong. I'm here on behalf of O4AD, the Oregon Association of Area Agencies on Aging and Disabilities. As many of you know, we represent seniors and people with disabilities receiving services under Medicaid and other programs such as Project Independence, and also our advisory councils, which are senior advisory councils as well as disability advisory councils. We had the opportunity to work with this bill as it was going through Human Services, and we do support the intent of this bill. We appreciate that there needed to be some concessions to be made to make it move forward, and we are very supportive of it going over to the Senate side. But more importantly, we appreciate the conversation about making our state more able to be utilized by as many people as possible, because while the bill in and of itself mostly is focusing on people with disabilities, it's important to remember that as more and more Oregonians and people in the country are aging, impairment also becomes a significant issue. My father is 82 years old. He was diagnosed with Alzheimer's in January. There is no way I can help him in a hotel at all. He's 6'2". So all of us are going to find ourselves in these kinds of situations looking for ways to be able to enjoy life, enjoy recreation, enjoy travel as much as we can, and we think this bill is a good first step and hope that there continues to be further conversation in the interim about accommodations for people with disabilities and impairments. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Bob Esterbrook from the Oregon Bureau of Labor and Industries, the agency that enforces civil rights and disability law, although not all of the ADA part of it is handled by the Building Codes Division at DCBS, and I think this bill actually starts to get it a little bit into their role, but we also are very supportive of the concept of the bill. We've been engaged in the discussions that have been going on, still have some sort of technical feedback for the bill, but we're very eager to see it move over to the Senate so that we can pursue those additional amendments. I'm happy to answer questions if there are any.
Any questions for this? And I thank the Bureau of Labor and Industry for recognizing that even though this bill is in its appropriate place, it would also have a reference to building codes, because that's where people go to look for the things that they're doing, and that's the technical minutes they're talking about. I appreciate that very much. So thank you both for being here. And that concludes the testimony for this bill. We don't have all the paperwork, so we'll do that on Monday, and we're going to close the public hearing on 2600, and we'll move the work session only to Monday. And with that, I think we're just about right for our time. So, just so other people know, we're going to move our other bills, 3240, 2853, over to Monday, because we have agreed to some invited testimony in a work session on House Bill 3100A. So, did I close my public hearing?
You did close the public hearing.
So, I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3100A, and we'll have a short explanation. I do have some representatives here, and I don't know if they're in the group or if they wanted to talk separately. Are you together with the whole group, or do you want to come up here at the beginning? You're welcome. I won't count this as part of anybody else's time.
Mr. Chair.
Thanks. They're here, and I think that's the right thing to do.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
You indicated this would be a work session. Is that correct?
It is a work session, but I'm being nice to these guys.
Oh.
There's some invited testimony. These
two? We're having some invited testimony, and they showed up, and I defer sometimes to people. So we're going to try to keep going. Yes, short explanation.
Thank you, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. House Bill 3100A approves the recommendation and management plan of the Land Conservation Development Commission and designates the Metolius River Basin as an area of critical state concern, prohibits the development in such area that has negative impact on the Metolius River or its springs or tributaries or fish and wildlife resources. It prohibits counties from siting destinations resorts within such area, defines contiguous as it appears in the management plan, declares an emergency as effective on passage. There are a number of amendments that have been advanced on this, and I'd be happy to describe them if you wish.
I'll let people describe them as they come up and see where we're at with that one. So with that, our two esteemed colleagues.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, I'm John Huffman, State Representative for District 59, which includes Jefferson County, and I am here today to argue on their behalf, as I think each of you would argue the same argument for each of your counties you represent. In 2005 and 2006, Jefferson County, in good faith, started down the road based on law and rule to map and zone for destination resorts. They completed that, and I think at this point it is an inappropriate use of the legislative process to be interfering in a good faith effort that they made to map and zone according to law. And I will leave it at that, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I could, if you're going to have testimony at the next meeting, I can wait. I'm here. This is not in my area. I'm a neighbor to the area. But I have more constituents writing me supporting this bill than probably any other legislator in the building. So I thought it was appropriate that I come. I'm Gene Wisnett, State Representative, District 53, rural Deschutes County, which maybe should be an area of critical concern because we have unemployment rate like my friend here in Jefferson County, close to 20%. I'm testifying in opposition to House Bill 3100, but not in opposition to the concept of establishing the areas of critical state concern or protecting the Metolius River. House Bill 3100 comes to you based upon the recommendations of the Land Conservation and Development Commission on this report here, 48 pages. I believe that this selection of the area of critical concern requires a much larger review and much more study than this rush to designate the Metolius River Basin as an ACSC. Second, I'm testifying in opposition to House Bill 3100, which is being rushed through the legislature to stop a legal action initiated in 2006 by Jefferson County elected officials who have followed the existing rules and laws. My third opposition is the scope of the area and the recommendation. Senate Bill 30. Do we have any committee members here?
I'll submit my
statement in writing. Senate Bill 30, submitted in 2007 session, had a much smaller area to protect in the Metolius River Basin called for in House Bill 3100A. My final point in opposition is I believe that this is a very unfair act against people's property rights. I want to conclude. I'm sure every committee member has read all 48 pages here, but let me give you some statements out of this 48-page recommendation. It says we work closely with the property owners for reasonable use of these lands. Second point, House Bill 3100 identifies an ACSE as the Metolius Basin, but the report describes an ACSE as the Metolius River watershed, which is part of the larger Deschutes River Basin. This needs to be clarified how much area we're talking about. The advocates for this bill claim the Bend Bulletin supports protection of the Metolius. In fact, the report says the bulletin called for preserving a strip along the river as a national park. Tom McCall in 1974 requested LCDC and the commissioners consider Fly Creek portion of this area as an ACSE. I'm trying to say that it wasn't this whole area. The resort, it's in this report that they could maybe offset $500,000 a year in federal timber payments with resorts, and also the school district in Culver would benefit. An objective of this ACSE is to include provisions that provide a fair return to the three directed affected property owners. That's in the report. The alternative locations for resorts recommended, LCDC recommended alternative locations for these resorts, and they received much opposition as they were put into a high-value land irrigated district. In closing, I do not oppose the designing, designating areas of critical state concern, but I oppose 3100 about changes, and I do support protecting the Metolius River. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members.
Thank you, Bull, for coming. Oh, questions? Thank you, Bull.
Thank you.
Representative Clem. And if you have some other people who are coming forward, they can come with you as well. Okay. And we said there's about, you have as much as 20 minutes.
Okay.
That'll be it.
Oh. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Brian Clem, State Representative from here in Salem, House District 21, Chair of the Agriculture, Natural Resources, and Rural Communities. In case you're wondering what this pile is, I'm not a big mystery guy. This is all the correspondence from this session. I can show you last sessions on a different bill that my office has received in support of this bill. It's about 2,000 postcards from around the state. Most of these come from Central Oregon. And this is the opposition that I collected from committee or things that were sent to me. So how did I get involved in this odyssey? February of 2008, we were here in special session. I had just had a young infant born 7 or 8 days earlier and was pretty tired. And there were some farmers from Central Oregon, who came, Crook County, who wanted to talk to me about destination resorts. And I really hadn't heard a lot one way or the other about them. And they said, you know, could you look into this? We believe there's a problem. They're harming some farming operations. They know I'm interested in agriculture. I said, maybe, but I've just got a baby. I'm not sure, you know, what I'm going to be able to do here. Senator Avakian kind of assigned me with, former Senator Avakian, assigned me to do a work group on the topic. I really didn't have the time with our daughter to do that. So I requested you, Mr. Chair, could I do a field hearing at some point just to gather information about destination resorts? And I was able to get permission from the Speaker and my chair to go out and do that. It turned out LCDC was doing one anyway, so we combined for staff saving purposes the hearings. And you had LCDC and the House, one-man House Subcommittee on Destination Resorts of the Ag and Natural Resources Committee hold a hearing on October 15th in Prineville, Oregon. At that hearing, there was maybe 150 people there. The Crook County Commissioners earlier that day had repealed their destination resort overlay map due to an initiative by some of their citizens that had put on the ballot that they felt there had been enough. There had been a lot of people there concerned, and whenever we go to Central Oregon, and I've been out there twice now for hearings where from the legislature, and then I've been out there another time for critical concern hearings and listened to the other ones that were out there, it's a total of about 6 or 7. It's often, you know, it's kind of like a civil war, and often it'll be farmers versus destination resorts. In this case, there were people at that hearing testifying about the Metolius, too, because it was just about destination resorts generally. and a woman named Linda Davis, who I had never met before. She's a former county commissioner herself and a former city planner. She came up when it was her turn and said, I just don't understand why you don't designate the area an area of critical concern and have a management plan. And I stopped the public part, and I asked the agency, what is that? I've never heard of that. And they said, it is a provision within our land use laws. It was in Senate Bill 100. It's been attempted five times, I think, was the answer I was given, and three of them were preempted by the federal government, either purchasing the land or creating the Gorge Act. And then at least one or two were rejected because they just weren't workable. For example, making all federal lands an area of critical concern, and that wasn't going to happen. So I came back from that meeting, and I've been thinking a lot about the Metolius at this time, and I had people asking me about, you know, is someone going to re-sponsor the ban on destination resorts? And I said, you know, I don't know, but the one piece of discomfort I had with that approach is it was a bill outside the land use system. This area of critical concern requires no new laws. It is on the books. It's been on the books since 1973. And so I called one of my constituents who happens to inhabit Mahonia Hall, which is in my district. Couldn't get him, of course. And so some staff people came over to meet with me, and I asked them. I picked up an idea while I was out at this subcommittee hearing. What would you think about designating an area of statewide critical concern? It's a two-part process. The LCDC has to do fact findings and public hearings, and actually they don't even have to do that. They may designate one. I mean, there would be a public meeting, but they don't have to do those types of hearings. They chose to. And they said, we think the governor would be supportive. Let us check it out. And then a couple weeks later, he concurred and initiated the process. I began talking to the landowners about that time because they had been monitoring the destination resort hearing and wanted to know what was going to happen next, and started telling them, I think this is the route we're going to go. It's going to have some standards in there, though, about protection for the river and wildlife, and you know, they're going to be tough to protect the river. And, well, okay, maybe we could meet them, maybe not. You know, need to see it in writing, that kind of thing. So the LCDC kicked off that process. I had House Bill 31 drafted up as a vehicle to accept their recommendation, not knowing what it would be at that time. And so I monitored the process. I listened for 4 hours on a cell phone to the first hearing because 400 people came and overflowed the room. I attended the final one in Madras, maybe 100, 150 people in a gymnasium, went to like 11 at night. And so I tried to track and listen to the public on those issues. Meanwhile, the commission, who was listening to the public, also having some negotiations with the property owners, really primarily, I think it turned out to be the Colsons, who, that's where an agreement of sorts was reached. If there's going to be a limitation, the Dash 23s, Tom's sitting around here somewhere, he can nod, they support those amendments. And those allow them to go forward with a 120-unit project on their property. From that point, then, the commission made a unanimous recommendation to the Legislative Assembly to adopt the Metolius River Basin as a statewide area of critical concern. That then has been received by this legislature. I know that one of my good friends said this is rushed. It doesn't feel rushed to me. I mean, this is now the end of the session, and this bill has still not left the House. And so we had testimony in the Land Use Committee, of which I serve. We received a do-pass recommendation to this committee almost 2 months ago now. From that committee, after holding two more public hearings where we had overflow rooms, and the testimony usually is about like this versus this, and that's where we find ourselves today. Now, the amendments A23 clarify a couple of points that relate to the management plan to make sure that the Ponderosa Ranch, I think is what they call it, that it can be on some nodes and clusters there in the bill. They support the Dash 23 amendments. There's one new amendment that was not in the Land Use Committee, hadn't been talked about. That's that any future amendments to this management plan, if the LCDC were to attempt to change the management plan, that the management plan must require that the commission give notice of proposed amendments to the governing bodies of Jefferson County and the Confederated Tribes of the Warm Springs. Because one of the concerns I've heard from Jefferson County particularly is, you know, if you'd just gotten this to us earlier, if we could get more notice and discuss it, you know, we might have been able to get on board. with something. So this is a new amendment that would give any new changes to this over to them. If they file a written objection to the proposed amendment, then the commission has a far higher standard before they can adopt the amendment, a clear and convincing evidence standard, which would normally be a much lower standard. So that's a gesture on future guidance to the management plan. And then the real guts of the plan are that there would be allowed small-scale development under 10 houses, unaffected. Measure 49, not terminated. That's why Oregonians in Action isn't here, or the realtors are not here. But that development in that area, large-scale development defined as 10 or more, would be required to not have a negative impact on the Matolius River, its springs, or its tributaries, not have an impact on fish resources in the area of critical concern, and not have a negative impact on wildlife resources. And those are the criteria. And if you are 10 or under and you can meet those, then you're good to go. If you are, no, excuse me, 10 or under, and you don't even have to meet those. If you're 10 or over and you can meet those, you're good to go, with one exception. There is, county may not approve citing a destination resort in the Matolius area of state critical concern. So that's the basic makeup of the bill. I think it's an extraordinarily important bill to the state of Oregon. I grew up in Coos County, and the beach, the public beaches, which also had been preempted at one point by the state for private ownership of the beaches, I appreciated and believed in it because my family never would have been able to afford a beach home or to get out on the beach and have a nice fenced-off beach area. And that's one of the rare places that I believe require a statewide look. And the beach, the Matolius River, maybe Crater Lake, it's already federal. I mean, those are the kinds of things that I think reach this threshold. I concur with the LCDC's unanimous recommendation. I concur with the Land Use Committee's due pass recommendation. I'm on it. I voted for it. And I would just remind folks that in the statute for destination resorts, if that's where a concern comes from, there are other ways, and there were other ways, to choose to build destination resorts. The process used is also listed in our land use statutes, and it says that the siting of destination resort facilities is an issue of statewide concern. If you flip back three pages, there are other areas of statewide concern. Now, the other areas, this land use tool, is 25, 26 years, it's 1987, so it's only about 18 years older, but they both reside in our statutes. They are both land use tools. In another bill, as I think many of you know, there is granted an opportunity if this project is on the Dutch Pacific parcel. There's granted an opportunity to go build up to two 160-unit resorts or communities in about 20 rural counties meet the definition. It's a long-term unemployment standard to help rural Oregon have a resort. It was important to me, after meeting with some of the Jefferson County commissioners who said, what their concerns were, it was important to make sure one project of a fairly large scale, given the environmental sensitivity, would be able to go forward and add a fairly significant chunk to their property tax base. That's Ponderosa Ranch. The other project is a lot smaller. Instead of 30,000 acres of ownership, it's only 640 acres. I do want to just correct a couple things that were stated earlier. The property rights, the legal rights on that property, if you check the zone today, is two. It is zoned forestry, and they have a legal right to two home sites. And that is not taken away by this bill in any way, shape, or form. The opportunity to win in the courts, perhaps prevail through the executive branch, that opportunity would be limited by House Bill 3100, and that opportunity would be transferred to other locations under other piece of legislation in this process. But no one is harming a property right of a property owner. It would be me, and 3100 would be limiting an opportunity to potentially prevail in the Supreme Court and be able to get all the necessary permits and water rights and move forward.
Okay. The dash 18s, were those yours as well?
No, 23s.
Okay.
Question.
Yes, Representative Edwards.
Representative Clem, just the 23s? Or I thought you referenced you referenced the 23s, and then I thought you also said something. I'm going back through my notes. You have one set of amendments.
23s.
Dash 23s. Got it.
This amendment deletes line 425, replaces it. Dash 23s only.
Dash 23s are your amendments?
Okay. Any other questions? Seeing none, thank you, and you kept to your 20 minutes. I appreciate that. So, with that, Hasina and whoever you want for the next. And we have one member that's leaving right at 5, so we might miss 3 minutes of your testimony. I will be here until your testimony is over.
Are we moving this?
No.
Okay.
It depends on if Gels is still here. If she's gone, we won't, and it's okay.
No, what won't we do if I'm not still here?
We're okay. We don't need them.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Hasina Squires. For the record, I'm here today in opposition of House Bill 3100. I represent the Dutch Pacific Resources. My client is Dutch Pacific Resources, commonly referred to as the Metolian, or even more commonly referred to as this session as the Eco Resort. With me today at the dais is one of my co-managers of the project, Shane Lundgren, who whose family represents five generations of Camp Sherman residency and has made his home there with his family. In 2005, my client purchased a 627-acre piece of property, which is located 3.79 miles from the headwaters of the Metolius, and the property was previously owned by Willamette Industries. Not previously, but it had been owned by Willamette Industries. It was had been logged unsustainably for decades, and our property is, as Representative Clem indicated, one of the two properties that Jefferson County chose to map as destination resort eligible in 2006. So far to date, my client has spent approximately $3.8 million in acquisition, entitlement, legal, and project planning costs to develop a 600-page development application for submission to Jefferson County. We're currently prohibited from submitting that application in its final form to Jefferson County since this case is on appeal at the Supreme Court. However, our entire development application is ready to go. We've posted it up on the website. We are not hiding anything about what our plans or our intentions are. We intend to stick to them. You could view that at our website, www.metolian.com. $1.5 million of that project, of that $3.8 million, has been spent over the last 12 months. So most recently, we've spent quite a chunk of change to develop this application project. Our project will consist, if it's allowed to go forward, of a 450 at full build out, 450 residential units and 180 overnight accommodations. And unlike any other destination resort, since we do fit in that category, because there is no other category that permits us in statute, our water will actually not be used. We will not be using groundwater. We will divert surface water, actually snow melt, that actually runs through our property, across our property for 4 months out of the year, and store it in three reservoirs. And as I said, groundwater will not be used. Our development will also establish a natural capital preservation fund, and so we're intending to seed it with initial dollars, and then a percentage of homeowners' fees will monthly go into a fund that will provide for restoration and enhancement projects that will be dedicated to the Metolius, to fund environmental projects within the Metolius Basin. Our project is a $215 million construction project that would result in the creation of over 100 new living wage jobs in Jefferson County. 100 jobs. I cannot stress that to you enough. We also believe that there's a social justice component that goes with our project. We will provide for 90 on-site employee housing units if our project is allowed to go forward. We oppose the bill because it will actually prevent our application from going forward and to build the state's first eco-community project within the Metolius Basin in an area that my clients firmly believe needs just this type of project. And it is exactly what they have planned for the last 4 years. To be clear about our preferences, what we would like, and I'll just briefly describe to you our amendments, we'd like to build our existing eco-resort as we've planned it under our 600-page development application. The Dash 19 amendment would allow that project to go forward. If we're prohibited from developing our entire full build-out project, we would like to develop a smaller eco-resort. There are economies of scale that can only be used at certain levels, and we would be able to in an environmentally friendly way and would be willing to stick to every single standard that we have outlined in previous legislation and would fit within our core existing principles. The Dash 20s would allow us to build a sort of a half of an eco-resort, 210 homes and 85 overnight accommodations. Furthermore, we oppose the portion of the management plan that provides that if a transferable development right is enacted and our rights are moved to some other rights or opportunities or whatever it is you'd like to call them, however you'd like to politically put it, if we're not allowed to afford the opportunity to move forward on this piece of property and we're given the chance to develop somewhere else in the state of Oregon, we object to that provision because it will take our current rights, opportunities, whatever it is you want to call it, again, down to two lots. I'd just like to close by saying that we firmly believe that this project will and does represent a new approach to development in Oregon. It has never been done before. Having represented this client for two legislative sessions, this is the second legislative session that you have seen me before you on this. I can honestly tell you that last legislative session, when we were fighting Senate Bill 30, my client indicated, we want to develop this green project. It's going to be green. We're going to not use groundwater. We're going to do all of these things. And there was a lot of ooh-la-la, wow, that sounds pretty amazing. Gosh, I hope you can do it. And I'm here to tell you today, they did. They put their money where their mouth was. They spent the money. They invested the time. They invested the resources. And they developed what they believe is an environmentally sustainable project and are ready to go forward with that. This county's unemployment is approaching 20%. A quarter of its population is on food stamps. This is 100 living wage. We're committing to living wage jobs in Jefferson County. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions and would turn it over to my client.
We'll let you speak first, and then we'll ask questions.
Okay,
thank you
very
for being
good.
Here.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name's Shane Lundgren, and I'm from Camp Sherman. So 100 years ago, in July 1909, my great-grandfather, John Zentbauer, he founded Jansen Knitting Mills in Portland, visited the Heising Resort on the Metolius River for the first time. And 10 years later, he purchased this property, and it's been in our family since then. And in the 1940s, after Pearl Harbor, my grandparents moved there and made it a small working ranch and raised their children there. So my father was raised there. So both sides of my family, mothers and fathers, have had their home in Central Oregon and operated a number of businesses there and also internationally. And I've actually moved my family back to the community and have been living there, raising my children. I serve on the school board and am active in the community and so forth. So we have deep roots there. We have currently a resort, which was the Heising Resort 100 years ago. It's now called House on the Metolius. We're right on the river. I would say we're some of the better stewards of that. That could be exploited if I were to be considered a developer. I think the reason that I purchased with Jim Keene the Metolian property was that might have deep roots and a deep interest in protecting what was in the Metolius Basin, and we didn't want to see this fall into the hands of someone who might do something untoward. And our objective has always been to create a vision for the future so the next 100 years of people who come into this area have an opportunity to respect it, to use it, enhance it, and think forward and not look at the past. Because if we wanted to look at the past, it would have been nice if my family could have closed the gates 100 years ago and we'd be the only ones there. So continuing with what I prepared to say, there's several years we've heard concerns about the Metolian's effects on the Metolius River, which have been interesting. And in response to those concerns, we've worked with some of the top engineers, hydrogeologists, to develop an innovative strategy that actually articulates this outdoor community, as Sasina said, using zero groundwaters, using water conservation measures, no golf course, non-native landscaping. So we've been called visionaries, yet people are trying to kill us. And this duplicitous sort of dialogue has been very troublesome to deal with. And coming out of SB 30, we had, you know, assurances over and over, yes, from the governor's office, nothing untoward would happen. We want to see where this goes. This is very interesting. So, again, committing to the resources, the land use system, following the rules, we followed the road as we should have, and we find it perplexing to be in the situation we are here, and very frustrating, I might add. It should be made clear that the Metolian is 4 miles from the river. Now, I took a friend out the other day who's actually the head of the World Water Council for the United Nations on a mountain bike, and we were riding up the road from the Mattole into Camp Sherman to go see how far we were from the river. Well, about 20 minutes into the ride, he said, were we lost? Where are we? So for people who sort of think we're next to the river, he said you could basically pump raw sewage into the ground out there, and it would percolate through lava rock and never touch the Mattole River. He said, what are people talking about? So I challenge people to come to Camp Sherman, come out to the property, put on your most comfortable shoes, and you'll walk more than an hour to get from our property to the Mattole River. So we are not going to impact the water on that river. I believe development and conservation can occur in tandem, as did Theodore Roosevelt. To that extent, our project seeks to address the impacts of a century of use in this basin and a growing population's desire to use it. Representative Clem talks about the Oregon coast and the fact that the beach is now accessible. Well, how do you have access? We're not proposing to limit access to the Mattole River or the National Forest. We're proposing to enhance, to sort of provide a window of opportunity, a jumping off spot to actually enjoy this area. So it's such a disingenuous argument that we're closing it off. And again, I think part of the portion of our conservation budget in setting up the Mattole Natural Capital Fund with the objective of funding water, fish, wildlife, energy, campground, forest thinning, all these things, there's a shortfall in the federal budget, there's a shortfall in the state budget, there's no local money. Who's going to pay for those things? So environmental groups want to stop everything, and there's this wonderful sort of photo opportunity of we're protecting everything. Where is the resource coming from that's going to actually protect those forests? Talk to the old-timers. I spent a lot of time, and my family has, with forestry people, water people. Where is that money coming from? They're perplexed. We propose to do that. We're going to contribute homeowners' fees, property sales taxes, and we'd provide an unprecedented level of funding locally in the Mattole Basin. I'll finish up for you. So getting back to the fact that the Mattole is capturing the imagination of people across the nation for its stewardship and sustainability platform, Oregon's known for being green. We've had a lot of calls from clients around the world interested in this project as a pilot project. As with anything, though, it must have an economically solid base and a year-round business model, and we believe that we have that. Hasina made the points about Jefferson County and what we think we can do there. So I would challenge everybody, all of you, to consider your actions really carefully, and your decisions will make or break the lives of many people in Jefferson County. And it's a great opportunity for Oregon, and we've played by the rules. We feel like we have a shot at it, and there's a reason we're still here. I think people fundamentally believe that this is something that should happen. And there's a lot of deep support in the community for what we're doing. We sort of have this sort of this noise on the top that's always appearing and sort of fighting us. But, you know, there's a lot of fundamental support for the ideas. And I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for either of these people? Not at this time.
Thank you.
We still have some more time, however. So.
Thank you very much for your time.
Yep. Thank you. Thank you for coming. And I think by my clock, they left you a good 10 minutes or so, so they used about half their time.
Talk fast. Thank you, Chairman Roblin and fellow committee members. I'm Mike Ahern, and I'm a seventh year as a Jefferson County Commissioner. Very pleased to be here. Jefferson County unanimously and emphatically is opposed to House Bill 3100. The state of Oregon, through the LCDC, showed up to work with us, and actually we were eager to work with them. We wanted to find a compromise. Most importantly, we wanted to protect the beautiful, pure Mattole River. Quite frankly, that was really not discussed much. This effort is in total an effort to ban any kind of resort of anybody's definition. And they were not interested in protecting the river like we were. And in your documents, you do have our proposed 3-mile buffer protection plan that actually protects the environment. That's what we're interested in. This ACSC is 23% of our county, 450 square miles. The Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs is 25% of our county. And we protect another 30% of our county as high-value farmland. The balance of our county is grasslands and rangeland with little dirt roads on it. I mean, this our county is, you see our county. I'm just trying to paint a picture of it with this additional 23% whopped out. We were opposed to the process. We were opposed to the hypothetical wells that we were presented with at the last minute. We were opposed to the lack of facts, and we have countered the facts time and again. Our attorney David Allen will do more of that today. We are absolutely opposed to the timeline for many reasons that I won't dwell on. A little more about Jefferson County. We are the most diverse county in the state of Oregon. Our school system has the most diverse population. We are a county of agriculture, tourism, and manufacturing. We are one of the poorest counties in this state, always after 30 out of 36. 19% unemployed and rising, highest use of food stamps in the state. We need another leg under our economy. The Eco Resort is ready to spend $215 million quickly, create 100 permanent good jobs. This is something that we, Jefferson County, can be proud of, and I believe the state of Oregon should and will be proud of. Just a little example, our poor county with a small tax base, we built a nice middle school recently in like 1999. It cost us $2 per thousand on our tax bill. That same school in Sisters cost them 20 cents. That's why they roll them out so fast. It's because Black Butte Ranch has a real market value of within a whisker of what the entire Jefferson County is. And I am, just to qualify myself, I'm the founder of the Black Butte General Store, so I love Black Butte Ranch. I think it's a wonderful resort, so I'm not using it in a negative fashion by any way. But we need to work on our tax base. That's what provides the public services that we want to provide our people. Fortunately or unfortunately, we're in the same media market as Bend, Oregon, and we read the Bend Bulletin. That's our daily newspaper. And I don't know, sometimes I think the state of Oregon has a bullseye on Jefferson County, because through this process, they're all of a sudden getting 300 homes out in the forest with this TDR at Skyline Forest. And I'm thinking, my gosh, Deschutes County, 23% of their tax base is resorts. You know, they got seven or eight of them. They're all over the place. We have none. And yet, in this legislative session, they're winning another charity. It's just hard to even swallow. When I saw that, I just thought, holy cow. But anyhow, Jefferson County has a proud history of protecting our resource lands. We have managed and worked with the state of Oregon's land use process. We have a proud agricultural sector that keeps us in check, actually, to be honest with you. We don't fool around with it. I just have to refer to Representative Klim, this Dash 23 thing. Well, we set our fees in June, which is next month, for the next year. And managing 23% of our county, when all of a sudden you can't divide the property, you can't deal well, hard to tell what else you can't do, but Jefferson County is going to manage it with no money from the state. We can't set fees after June. And we're charged with managing this thing. And I just say, you know, it's the injustice is so apparent. It's pathetic. We plead with you not to pass this and not to even get it on the floor of the House. But I do want you to know Jefferson County will work with the state hand in hand protecting the Metolius River.
Chair Roblin, committee, I'm Wayne Fording, Jefferson County Commissioner. I'd just like to touch a little bit on the process that's been brought up earlier. Jefferson County did follow the process. They've been at this since 05, 06. And it's not just the commission, current commission. It's been six commissioners that have worked through this process. And a lot of work's gone into it. And it looks like it'll be taken away in real quick fashion. I'd like to touch a little bit about the LCDC Commission. You know, they had their this recommendation came to the legislature on April 2nd. On April 17th, the LCDC meeting, they had a two-hour discussion about this resort, the Metolian Resort and the ACSC, and a motion was made to recommend that the Metolian be looked at as a possible fit inside the basin. Because that's one thing they did not look at through the process was the Metolian Resort, an eco resort inside the basin. One thing we never did get out of the DLCD was what is an explanation of large-scale development? Is a square mile of development in the Willamette Basin large-scale? You know, we never got that answer. It was just pretty much, this is what we're going to do. But during that time, three of the seven commissioners were in favor of an approach like that, but without the fourth vote, that never the motion was pulled off the table. I don't want to repeat what Mike said, but we were very disappointed with the information we were getting in the time frame. You know, within 48 hours from every hearing is when we got the documents. Hypothetical wells, and again, you know, they talk about the Metolius River, where this resort's 4 miles from the river, you know. As a newly elected county commissioner, I've been enlightened on how government works on the state level. When the rails are greased, things can happen in a very short time frame. Other times, it seems that the slow process is the preferred method. I think if our constituents knew how we do business in this building, they might just blow it up with all of us in it. And in closing, I'd like to say that legislation crafted to bypass local government processes is almost never the right answer. And I really consider you to think of how this affects our county. It is a very big deal to us in Jefferson County to be just bypassed. We were elected to do a job there by our constituents. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, David Allen, attorney for Jefferson County. I've submitted written testimony. I won't belabor reading through that. A lot of it is technical, certainly the last few pages, technical attacks regarding the legal aspects of the area critical statewide concern. I'd be happy to answer any questions either today or afterwards, should you choose to ask those. Those are the same arguments that the county intends to raise at the Court of Appeals, and attached to my exhibits are copies of our petition for review of the recommendation that the legislature has received from LCDC, as well as our request to LCDC requesting a stay of their recommendation. I would note on those two fronts, the date of our letter to LCDC was April 9th. We have asked them, pursuant to a rule, that requests that they stay their own recommendation. To date, we have not had any response from LCDC. This matter has not been brought before the commission. There's not been an approval. There's not been a denial. There's been no action. Something we're seeing quite frequently now with DLCD, now that the mad rush is over, to get you a recommendation. Our petition for judicial review was filed on April 9th. The deadline to file the record with the Court of Appeals was May 11th. On May 11th, the state filed a request for an extension, and the new deadline to submit their record is June 29th. The county finds it interesting that the process, this ACSC process, took a total of 77 days from the day LCDC initiated to the day the recommendation came, 77 days. By June 29th, the agency will have had 81 days to produce the record. It leaves one questioning, why does it take longer to produce a record than to create it? The delay serves a significant purpose. It's the same purpose that's gone on throughout this entire process. Hide the ball, rely on data that no one gets to see, and then at the very end, drop things like my Exhibit 5, this hypothetical well study. I'd ask any of you that have any familiarity with water law or any of the Water Resources Division rules to take a look at this map and question to yourself, how does this make any sense? And when you're doing that analysis, look particularly at Exhibit 6 and 7. Exhibit 6 talks about wells that have been drilled in the Metolius Basin area since 1965. Page 1 is the source of the data. We'll provide you our source of data, unlike DLCD, from the Oregonian. Page 2 shows you an overlay on this hypothetical well map of where all the wells in 1965 were. And page 3 shows you that same map currently in 2008. But most illustrative is page 7, Exhibit 7, excuse me. According to the Water Resources Division, I think it's been referred to as a mythical map, but not a hypothetical map, shows you the measured headwater flows at the headwaters of the Metolius River gauge. As you can see, there is a distinct variation in the headwater flows, but no particular downtick when any of these new wells came through. And in fact, the flows in 2008 are nearly identical to the flows in 1922. There's been no measurable impact to the headwaters of Metolius despite all of these wells being drilled. If the science behind Water Resources Division's map were true, you would see a significant downtick in Exhibit 7. Obviously, you do not. We've also noted for you Black Butte's golf courses in full development, a 4 mile distance from the headwaters, no measurable impact, and in fact, when the last golf course was done, flows actually increased dramatically. I think what you can conclude is the headwaters of the Metolius seems to be immune from any of the development certainly that's gone on in the area to date. The other thing DLCD talked quite a bit about and has made representations to this body, the legislature that is regarding wildlife, that somehow we are impinging upon wildlife in the area. Nothing could be further from the truth. Currently, the Supreme Court has required, or there is an appeal pending at the Supreme Court, I should say, regarding a one-mile stretch that's not even part of the mapped destination resort eligible land. It is the access from the highway to get to that land that traverses through a deer winter range. The only air to date that the courts of Oregon have found Jefferson County engaged in as far as their destination resort mapping is this one-mile stretch of road that's not even part of the destination resort mapped area. That is all the county would be required to address on remand should the Supreme Court be allowed to complete their job. That's the other argument that the county has been making throughout this. Representative Clem, respectfully, I have to disagree with his statement that House Bill 3100 does not affect the rights of anyone. It affects the rights of Jefferson County, its citizens, and the developers to allow the appellate process to be completed. For the legislature now to presume that they know better and to do an end run around the Supreme Court of Oregon, I challenge the legislature to find me another example of when you have interfered with a pending Supreme Court case. I'd like to go over just a little bit more regarding the aspects of the plan itself and what you're being asked to adopt. This process has been a rush to judgment. My conclusion in my written testimony, and I'll say it now, is what is the hurry? Everyone needs to get this done somehow by July 1, but the only stated reason is, well, these destination resorts are online. They're going to be there tomorrow. If you look at the timeline as part of my written testimony, we began our destination resort mapping process in 2006. It's now 3 years later, and we still have not made it through the appeals process on our initial attempt to map. There will be a remand. There will be remand proceedings and another year to two of delay as those go through the process. Then there will be a site development application, which will likewise be appealed. I'm here to tell you, destination resorts are years away from the basin, and there is no reason to rush and to avoid all the rules and goals that this body and LCDC ordinarily is required to comply with. In fact, if you look at the area critical statewide concern, it does not exempt this process from the statewide planning goals, in stark contrast to Director Whitman's comments at LCDC that they were not subject to the goals in this regard. I would also like to address briefly, since we were just handed these today, the Dash 23 amendments from Representative Clem, and I'll just point out something I've been pointing out along the same lines throughout this process. When you draft these rules, you need to be specific about what it is you're doing. The Dash 23 amendment directs LCDC to adopt the management plan by rule. Why? The Area of Critical Statewide Concerns Statute 197-405 puts the authority upon the legislature to adopt the management plan. It is the legislature's job to amend the ORS to write a bill that can be codified in law that somehow achieves this objective. It does not say, punt it back to the agency and let them write a rule. And in fact, it really points out the backwardness of this entire process. The way this should have gone is LCDC, if they were going to use the Area of Critical Statewide Concern process, should have promulgated rules to enact and implement that statute. Those rules would have set the groundwork for how an Area of Critical Statewide Concern would be handled at the agency level. There would be notice. There would be a rulemaking procedure. There would be hearings. There would be a rule that was vetted, and then finally a rule that would come to the legislature for endorsement. It would alleviate this backwardsness of the legislature now saying to the agency, go write a rule. It should have been the other way around. But everyone was in too much of a hurry, and if the truth be known, by the time the governor's letter came out to get this done in this legislative session, they knew they couldn't comply with the Administrative Procedures Act because there wasn't enough time. That's the only reason they're doing it this way. Given their druthers, and I respect Director Whitman's efforts in this regard, he has worked incredibly hard on this. But I believe if you asked him under truth serum, would it have been nice to have some more time to do this in a right manner, he'd have probably told you, yeah. There just wasn't enough time. But the Dash 23 amendment goes further, and it talks about, for instance, the commission's required to give Jefferson County notice of any proposed amendments. Is this going to be the ACSC standard 48-hour notice? Is it going to be 14 days notice? Is it going to be the notice we're required to give DLCD before we do anything of 45 days? It doesn't state. It talks about a definition of annual average consumptive water use in this 5-acre-feet thing you see in the management plan. I have yet to find what source Jefferson County is supposed to consult to determine whether 5-acre-feet of water has been consumed. Who's keeping that data? Is the county required to keep that data? Where's the baseline? These types of things may seem minimal to you, but as the attorney who implements this at the local level, I can assure you it's a headache trying to figure out what will LUBA ultimately do with this. So I'd ask that the legislature provide some more guidance and some more specificity. Actually, what I'd ask the legislature to do is this. Kill House Bill 3100, recognize it's bad law, recognize it is an end run around local control, recognize that the state of Oregon and the Metolius Basin deserve a better product, deserve a more fully vetted process. Kill House Bill 3100, direct the agency to engage in rulemaking procedures if you like, come back in 2011, and let's try again. I'd be happy to take any calls, and thank you for your time.
Any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We have exceeded our time. We have an option. We're in a work session. We can amend the bill by putting in an amendment if we desire. We can take no action because we're going to carry it over. We don't have all the stuff we need. We have heard the amendments that have been proposed to the state. I'm looking to see if there's any druthers or from different people.
Are the amendments required for fiscals and revenues?
No, we can get them. We can get the fiscals and whatever from them with or without the amendments added.
I'm fine moving the Dash 23s.
If you want to make that motion, I would.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 23s into House Bill 3100.
Representative Edwards moves the Dash 23 amendments to House Bill 3100. Is there any discussion? Being that.
Could I have just like a
30-word
summary to remind me since, I'm sorry, I missed
of the dash ones, yeah. Representative Clum can come up and do that. Oh, do you have them? 23?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Olin, Madam Chair from the Land Use Committee, the differences between these and what we're sent here in the Land Use
Thank
Committee
you.
Is it corrects the technical
Representative
problems.
Clem, address who you are.
I'm sorry. Once again, Brian Clem, State Representative, District 21. They correct the technical problems on the word contiguous and the roads on the Colson property. They deal with the water issue on it, and then they have this additional provision for, it's not a veto authority, but a higher standard if either Jefferson County or the tribes were to object to any future amendments. That any future amendments, if there ever were any to LCDC, the tribes and Jefferson County would be given the opportunity to file a written objection, and then it would make a higher standard for the LCDC to adopt those amendments, and if someone challenging them in court, they would have to meet a clear and convincing standard.
Thank you for the indulgence. Now that you've reviewed it, I remember the difference from when
okay.
It left the committee, the Land Use Committee.
Representative Burke.
Mr. Chair, it is your intention to move just the amendment
Correct.
And not the bill.
Correct.
I will be voting no.
On the amendment? Okay. We'll take a roll call vote on the amendment.
Representative Burrard?
Excused.
Representative Gelser?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Excused.
Representative Nolan?
Yes.
Representative Reed?
Aye.
Vice Chair Berger?
No.
Vice Chair Edwards?
Aye.
Chair Roblin?
Aye. So the amendments are approved. And with that, I guess before I close the deal, if there are people here who would like to submit some testimony to this committee, if they get it to our administrator, we will get it to other people just because I think it's important to have as much information as we can. And we will be moving this work session to Monday. I don't know if we're going to get to work on it that day, but we will move it forward. And
A word, Mr. Chair?
Yes. Representative Berger.
Before you close it, this has been, you know, one of the most controversial things we've heard this session, and I just will retain any remarks until Monday.
Okay.
Okay, but I just don't want it to be like we weren't paying attention here.
Right. No, I agree.
Okay.
I agree. That's,
thank you.
And I do want, it's one of the reasons for carrying it over. I mean, I think we do have to have the conversation, and there may be other information that people want to get, so I agree with that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And I would like to say that I appreciate all the information that was provided to us. I was listening and I was reading, and this is helpful.
Okay. Thank you with that. And with that, we'll close our work session on 3100, and we'll close our hearing on the Rules Committee for today. Thank you all for being here.